If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
It's time for an AFM Radio original program.
Good evening. This is Space Pirate Radio on astronomy.fm. It is 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we are live. You are joining us in the chat room. We've got a lively crew tonight to help participate in an interview show. Hello. Jerry,
hi,
Myra.
How are you doing?
Yeah, if you, my distinguished guests could introduce themselves one at a time. We've got Jerry.
Jerry Hubble. I work for Explore Scientific. I've been on the show a few times.
Yes. Good friend of ours.
Hi,
and I'm
Myron Wasuda. I am a second time on the show guest. I was on a couple of months ago with Jerry about the observatory we're talking about tonight, and I'm an optometrist and an amateur astronomer, of course.
Excellent, excellent. And you two are both from the South with the Rappahannock Astronomy Club?
That's correct.
Yes.
Myron's been a long member of the Astronomy Club. I joined, I think, about 7 years ago. And we've talked about this before, Diane. I was a loner for a long time and then decided all of a sudden to become, to start being social. So, but Myron actually was, I think, close to being one of the founders of the club. Is that correct?
Yeah. You know, our club is in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And when I moved here in 1990, the club was then called the Triangulum Astronomical Society. And it was kind of a small knit group of people that would meet in our homes once a month and then have a mini star party in the backyard afterwards. And then we slowly evolved to a more larger group and got a nice meeting area in one of the community rooms and grew from there. And at some point decided we needed to change our name because it was a little more obvious to us that we were getting members from all different parts of our region. And so we decided to rename ourselves the Rappahannock Astronomy Club after after the river that goes through Spotsylvania and Caroline counties and King George County. So it just made everybody feel a little more inclusive in the club. And it's grown since then. And we've now got 75 members or so, and 15 or 20 people show up at the meetings each month. And it's a very active group.
That does sound like a really good active group. So Fredericksburg, Spotsylvania, was big into the Civil War when I was younger, so those are very evocative names for me, but not names I necessarily associate with astronomy. So How are the skies in that area?
They're surprisingly good, believe it or not. We're about 50 miles south of D.C. and about 50 miles north of Richmond. And actually where Jerry and I live is about 15 miles west of Fredericksburg. So we're kind of like halfway between Fredericksburg and a little town called Culpeper. And so our skies are really pretty good. And maybe we can get fifth magnitude fairly routinely and on really good nights, maybe even close to 5.5. It's
And you can see, and typically you can see the Milky Way when it's really clear, you know, and you don't see it, of course, like it is out west, like we talked about last time, where you can't tell the difference between all the constellations, the bright stars and the dimmer stars. There's so many stinking stars you can't align your telescope. But you can see the Milky Way peeking through a little bit when the sky is clear and not hazy.
So, do any of the battlefields and historical sites, do those act as a buffer for your observing zones?
Yeah, that they actually do. There's an active conservation effort in the area. The Civil War Trust.
Oh yeah, I'm a volunteer. I'm a donor for that.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. Well, I'm not a donor or a volunteer, but I've just recently gotten into helping out with volunteering, maintaining trails in the area that run through the battlefield. So I'm learning history as I do that, And there's a lot of open space that's undeveloped, and they're trying to keep it that way. But unfortunately, we, as everywhere, are being encroached by lights. And I think it's an ongoing struggle and battle to keep these battlefields in their relatively undeveloped states.
Well, that's a really interesting thought as far as for perhaps other groups, especially in the eastern coast and the south, could take advantage of pairing up with that kind of conservation association to create buffer zones. I will certainly be keeping you all.
There are actually active groups from the counties as well. I know Spotsylvania County, which is what the county we live in, is actively pursuing lighting ordinances now, where 10 years ago they really didn't. And there's another local county, Rappahannock County, which is nearby, that's got actually some very strict lighting ordinances in. So I think people are getting the message that it's not only good for amateur astronomers like us, but it's good for just aesthetics. It's good for nature and animals and wildlife, and good for the county's pocketbook. You save money if you conserve electricity. So.
Well, I will definitely be keeping you all from the Rappahannock Club in mind next time I get an appeal for, say, Culpeper County. That's a
yes, thank you.
Neat piece of synergy there. Okay.
Yeah, that sounds good. Uh-huh.
So you also do have star parties at Caledon State Park?
That's right. Exactly. Every month. We have every month, and we've gone through some changes in that area. Originally the star party was designed for club members to do dark sky imaging or dark sky observing. And that's the time to invite people, you know, public to come out and see things. But what we've discovered, we've seen this over the years, is that, you know, typically when you do outreach events, you know, beginners want to see something that's bright and easy to look at and don't have to want to struggle to understand what they're looking at. So, you know, that's kind of contrary to a dark sky site, you know, when you want to just look at faint objects. So we've kind of developed or changed our philosophy a little bit on for public outreach events at Caledon. We're starting to schedule them during the time of first quarter moon, which is typically the best time to look at the moon, you know, give or take a few days, and then also whatever planets have to be happen to be in the sky at that time, we do that also. But so our philosophy has changed over the years. You know, the goal is really public outreach. It's not the club members. We can use other sites for dark sky, you know, typically. And so I guess the dichotomy there is a kind of a struggle with the club members, because you like to see all the club members come together. But a lot of some deep, you know, dark sky observers or deep sky object observers don't care to come out when the moon's out. They don't really, you know, so.
Oh, that's definitely a struggle. With one of our major public events up here in southeastern Michigan, where Marty and I are from, we've even decided that the public has a great time on a full moon night. They do, especially.
Oh, yeah.
We have clouds a lot in Michigan, so at least if you've got really dodgy skies, you've got a full moon to look at. And so, hey, let's have our big events for the public on a full moon night. Well, obviously that sparks a little resistance from the volunteer squad, because they think of a full moon night as the absolute worst thing you can be showing anybody. But as you said, people coming out for the first time want to see something nice and dark.
And bright,
yeah. They want to see, they don't want to be squinting at little faint galaxies, even if you tell them that it's, you know, 77 million light years away. That's exciting, but not exciting enough.
Right. And
you
then,
Jerry, one of the most fun public events I did recently was exactly like you're saying. It was a full moon observing session where I set up a little telescope. It was a little 66 millimeter refractor, and I put a video camera on it. I displayed it on a large screen TV outdoors on a table, a picnic table. And we looked at the moon through the telescope and with our eyes, and we used our imaginations and tried to draw create as many pictures using the dark mare as we could. And we found the man on the moon. We found the face on the moon, the lady on the moon, the rabbit on the moon, the man carrying the sticks on the moon. You know, it was just fun engaging the public in that respect. They had a great time.
That sounds like a really cool plan. So we've got Marty. Hello, Marty.
Hello, I am here. Yes, I found I had a strange button clicked that shouldn't have been clicked, and that was preventing me from coming on.
Uh-oh.
Oh, I'll
mute.
Minor detail.
No, what? No, I checked all the mute buttons. Something. So I kind of missed the conversation, so I don't know where you started out at. So just keep going. And...
Okay, well, we were talking about where they're from and the brief history of their club and their observing sites.
Okay.
And so I know that the focus tonight is they've got a very interesting project in the form of an special observatory that you two gentlemen want to lay it on us, feel free, because this is a great story and quite a moving story.
Myron, why don't you start out with a short history of how we got started with this, you know, a minute or two, and then we can go into what we're doing now.
Yeah. As I was saying earlier about the club earlier, I've been a member for a long time, and one of the early members of the club was also a prominent member, a prominent astrophotographer. His name was Mark Slade, and Mark was one of these kind of guys that could build anything from anything. He was very mechanically inclined, and so he built his own telescope, and he built his own telescope mount, and he built his own cold cameras. And this was in the days of film, back in the 1990s. He was using the latest emulsions like TechPan and PGM and all these films, trying to push them to their limits and getting pretty amazing astro photos, hand guiding with his eye, you know, looking through a reticle with a pulsating light for an hour at a time. Somehow he could do that, you know, and he just loved seeing the images that he would get on film. And he inspired me when I was in the club in those days to think about astrophotography, because primarily I was a visual observer in those days. So we would go out and we would, set up our telescopes, and I would look visually all night long, and he'd be photographing all night long. But, you know, we had this common ground of love of the stars. And so we became friends. And over the years, many, many years went by, and he basically got me interested in astrophotography finally. And I started in the days when the CCD cameras were just coming on, like in mid 90s.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Actually, my wife, when we got married, as a honeymoon present, she bought me a CCD camera. It was the little Electrum. Yeah, it was the EDC 1000. I don't know if you remember that. There was a company called Electrum. And they had this little tiny camera that had a little teeny chip, 192 by 165 pixels, little teeny thing. But boy, it was so amazing what you could see with that on the planets and the moon compared to what we were getting on film.
Mm-hmm.
I instantly adopted digital at that point, because I never really got into film. But Mark sort of stayed and hung out with film for a long time after that, and decided eventually that he would get a digital DSLR. And so that was his foray from film. He jumped right into a DSLR instead of going to like the really cool CCD cameras that, you know, you were seeing some of the amateurs using in the, you know, late 90s and early 2000s and even into, you know, mid 2005 and 10. But Mark never gave up film. He continued to observe and photograph with his telescopes. But he, as he got older, realized he wanted to build an observatory that was commensurate with his interests. So he bought some property along a lake nearby here and started building a house. It was a multi-year project. He was building it himself. So, and of course, working the way he did, you know, he didn't have much time to build a house. So it took a number of years. But along the way, he started buying the parts that he needed for his observatory, like a dome and a really nice digital control system for the dome and a telescope, a 12-inch SCT Mead LX200 telescope that he was going to computerize and put in his dome. And he wanted to control it from his house. So he was going to run wires from his home to the observatory. So he had a lot of this remote control software, he was just collecting this stuff. He wasn't really using it because he didn't have a place to put it. His house was being built, and his current house that he was living in was in the woods and didn't really have a good view of the sky. So it was just a long-term project he had in mind. Well, he finally finished the house in 2014 and started moving in, and then started construction of his observatory in 2014. And unfortunately, he had a catastrophic health crisis in 2015, and he passed away in March of 2015. And it was just a blow to me because it was so sudden. Yeah. But after the initial shock, I went over to his house and we talked. I talked with his wife, and he had all this stuff, you know, that he was building this observatory with that never really got built. He had everything he needed almost, but it wasn't put together. So at that point, you know, I said, well, whatever you want me to do to help you with, you know, getting finding a home for all this stuff, you know, let me know. What do you want to do? Do you want me to post it on online and sell it, or, you know? And she said, well, you know, why don't we talk about this some more and let's just think about it. So a few days later, I came back with the idea that why don't we build his observatory like he wanted? Let's build his observatory and let's devote it to the two things that Mark loved the most, which was astrophotography and showing off his pictures and outreach to trying to bring the love of the sky and the beauty of the universe to the average person who might not otherwise see it. And she loved the idea. So she basically donated everything lock, stock, and barrel to me to do whatever I wanted. And at that point,
that's phenomenal.
I knew I had to build his observatory. And not only would it be controllable from our house, it would be controllable from around the world. And not only would it be available to just the few people that he knew, I was going to make it available to the entire club and indeed the entire region and the entire community of amateur astronomers. And we were going to do this for free. And that was the mission statement of this observatory. However, I had the idea, I had the dream, but I didn't have the technical know-how to do this. And that's where Jerry Hubble came in. It just so happened that Jerry and I had started to become acquainted with each other a couple years prior to that. And Jerry was very busy writing his book on, of all things, remote observatories. And it's like, whoa, this is like, you know, talk about a bad situation becoming a good situation. I knew Jerry was just the person, the catalyst that could make this really happen. And the rest is history. And if it wasn't for Jerry, this observatory wouldn't exist. So,
well, I think you had a lot to do with it. You had a lot to do with it too, Myron. You brought us all together, I think, to help do this project.
I was sort of a catalyst in a way too, and I think it was the right people getting together at the right time, and had also some generous support from people in our local astronomy club. When I pitched the idea to Jerry, said, look, I'm going to need your help on this. What do you think? Can we do this? Is this possible? I mean, is this something we can do for relatively little money, because we didn't have a whole lot of money to put into it? And he said, I think it is. He gave me a ballpark figure of several thousand dollars that what we would need probably to get it online. So I set up a GoFundMe account, and we had some donations from local amateur astronomers in the community, and as well from the Rappahannock Astronomy Club. And that was enough. We got enough. We met our goal of $2,000 to begin construction on the structure that would house this telescope. And we had the dome. We had the digital control software. We had the remote control weather station. We had everything we needed to make this happen. We even had a little computer that we used for a little while. And we decided that, you know, the best place to build it was my backyard, because it was a fairly dark location, and I already had a deck in the backyard that was supplied with power and was close enough to the house that we could get a Wi-Fi signal out there. So it was a good test bed for this location, but it wasn't the best location in terms of accessibility to the sky. So it was somewhat of a compromise, because we do have some trees that block the observatory to the north and to the northeast and to the northwest. So we have some blockage of sky there. So people that are using the observatory have to realize that there is an artificial horizon that's in play that we have to respect, you know, in terms of what the observatory can see and can't see. So That's kind of where we started, yeah. And I'll let Jerry take over with the details of what we got and how we got the systems all working and everything.
So when I came in, we had quite a bit of equipment to integrate, and for me, I've been working for Explore Scientific for 3 years, at that point it was about 2 years, and I know, and I'd been developing a mount controller system for Explore Scientific for the last 3 years, and so I had some equipment to help with building the observatory. We started out with the LX200, fork mount, and unfortunately, we invested some money into that to try to upgrade the controller, get that up to speed, because this scope and fork mount that we got was about 20 years old already.
20 years old, okay. Yeah.
So it's an old LX200 classic, 12-inch. And so we had to make that work, which it worked for a while. We got it to work pretty well, actually. I got some upgraded instrument, a piece of a drive corrector called Telescope Drive Master helped us run them out with little to no issues, as far as having to pay attention to, auto guiding can be kind of a pain sometimes because you got to babysit it when you're doing astrophotography. But the drive corrector, the Telescope Drive Master, helped us simplify our operations in that regard. That was just one piece that we didn't have to worry about. So that was a piece I brought from Explore Scientific into that. I got a donation from Scott Roberts, who's a company president. Y'all may know him pretty well, but he was generous and donated that piece of equipment to us for the observatory. And then we integrated that. We got the system up and running. There was a few other things. I brought some software licenses that I had already owned. I brought to the table that we could use in the observatory as opposed to, my plan was to use the observatory as opposed to me setting up my portable system all the time. Mm-hmm. At that point, I just transferred, loaned my licenses to the observatory for like Maxim DL and a few other small pieces of software that I had license for. And so that's how we brought the software together and to get the system up and running. And we use a very nice remote control, remote access software called TeamViewer. A lot of your listeners may be familiar with TeamViewer for remote control purposes and observatories. It's a very nice piece of software. It's you're virtually sitting at the desk in the observatory I'm 5 miles away, and it's just like I'm sitting there operating the telescope. So that helps a lot, that kind of system. So I was brought in, I built, integrated the pieces parts to make it all work, basically, is what I was able to do. And it's been fairly, it's a big learning curve, of course. We've had issues, generally little, you get three or four things working, get it up and running to a certain level, and then something starts not working right or breaks. Mm-hmm. And then you work on that.
Yeah,
and
Jerry, you were saying about the mount that, so you were going to make a point, I think, about the LX200 mount eventually failed. And so yes, we had to replace the fork mount with the German equatorial that's in there now.
Yeah, so what
so you want to tell them a little about that?
One of the things with the controller I built, we're bundling it with the Losmandy G11 mount, and I have one that I've had for the last year or so for testing. So I told Scott Roberts that I was going to go ahead and, I'd been testing it in a portable mode for a while, and I said, I'm going to install this in the observatory so we have a nice permanent location to really do long-term testing for the system. Mm-hmm. So he agreed to that. He loved the idea, which is really awesome. So we installed the G11 in the observatory we deforked the LX200 12-inch optical tube and put it on put a Losmandy plate on it and put it up on the mount, and it works great. I'm real happy with its performance. The pointing has been good. The tracking's been really good. We did some measurements over the last couple of minutes. We installed it, 2 months ago, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, right, that sounds about right.
Right at the end of December. Yeah. And It's been fine ever since. One of the philosophies I have for astrophotography is you want, and for visual use also, you want your equipment to disappear. You don't want anything to hinder your access to the object that you're interested in looking at. You want it to be completely transparent. You don't want to have to think about your mount. You don't want to think about your camera. You don't want to think about, you know, the tracking. Is the tracking good? Is all this stuff working right? You want to just make sure, you know, it's the best that it can be, and then make it disappear. You want to focus on your object and going from one, you know, if you're doing astrophotography like I do, minor planet work, I want to be able to jump from one object to the next and take images and not worry about the equipment working at all. So that's my performance goal for our operations, which is pretty high standard, I think, especially when you're dealing with all kinds of different versions of equipment. Like, we've got the old scope, but we've also got an old, we start out with the ATIC 314 camera that I had, that I started out with, and then I bought an SBIG 2000, ST2000 camera, which was 10 years old. And then recently we just acquired, I went ahead and bought a QHY 163 Charlie camera, which is a color CCD imager, which, you know, I discussed it with Myron, and he thought it was, he suggested that we try to get access to a nice one-shot color camera, because it's easier for people to learn, if, you know.
Right.
It's easy to do color photography for people that don't want to mess with filters, basically. Mm-hmm. And but we have quite a bit of equipment now. You know, I decided to purchase this stuff because I know I would use it, and I know it would be useful for others. And it's on loan, and we're still looking for some. I think we're going to start another round of fundraising. Because we really want the observatory to stand on its own. We don't want to be relying on a huge amount of loaned equipment that might disappear on us one day.
Excellent point.
So that's one thing. We're very fortunate right now to be able to have access to this equipment through Explore Scientific and others. I know Myron has donated quite a bit of stuff, too. Over the last year,
mostly the backyard location and many trips back and forth to the dome from the house in the middle of the night to plug in or unplug a USB connector or a power supply, because, you know, the learning curve on this has been immense, as Jerry said, and while we're almost there, we're not quite at the point where the equipment disappears, but we're close. I mean, I think we've done, I'm really proud of the job that Jerry and I have done to really work with limited resources that we had and not spending a whole lot of money to really get a really nice remote observing station that's pretty reliable and is fun to use and is under a pretty dark sky. I mean, my house is in a neighborhood that's literally right next to where the Battle of Wilderness was fought.
Oh, neat.
You know, in the 1860s. Yeah. And so the skies are pretty decent out here. And as we mentioned, so it's a pretty capable observatory. But someday we are, you know, we're going to need to find a home for this, because we both envision this observatory being sort of an endowment, a gift to the local community as well as the global amateur astronomy community. We'd like to be able to have this observatory continue on. And so we're going to need to find a permanent home for it somewhere. So something down the road that we're going to be looking at is a little piece of land somewhere that we can put it on. And more than likely it will probably associate with a local community college or maybe even a local foundation that is in our area. That's purpose is to preserve and protect some ancestral land from early immigrants that came to Virginia from Germany. They're called the Germana Foundation.
Okay.
They have a nice area, about 150 acres near the Rapidan River, where Orange County and Spotsylvania County come together. And so it's a very dark site out there as well. So if we can figure out some way to incorporate, you know, the observatory and have a steady stream of funding already set up so that the Germana Foundation or the Germana Community College doesn't have to be putting a whole lot of money into it, I think it'll be a partnership that will be attractive to them, and it will allow this observatory to persist for, you know, many years after maybe Jerry and I are able to give it the attention that we're giving it right now.
That is excellent. And that is something that I did want to discuss with you both in a bit. But it is the bottom of the hour. So, Marty, it's time for our station ID.
You are. Go ahead. Give jars in there. All right. Listen to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. That means it is another Wednesday evening, halfway through our programs. So that means it's 9:30 in the evening on Wednesday, March the 1st, 2017. So universal time, that would put it Thursday morning, 2:30 in the morning, Thursday, March the 2nd, 2017.
Second.
Yep. So we're still live. And, of course, that means our chat room wide open, and welcome aboard. So if you're listening in and you want to ask us a question, come over to our chat room, astronomy.fm/chat. That'll get you there. Go to the homepage. I'll get you there also. More than happy to have you come over to our chat room. Even if you just want to hang out, you can ask us questions or ask anybody else in the chat room questions too. So feel free to do that. And glad to have you listening in. By the way, coming up after Space Pirate Radio, we've missed you. It is Astronomy Ireland and other programs too. So glad to have you here, everybody.
Yeah.
Let's continue on. And don't forget, we'll repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So if you miss part of it, you'll catch it later.
So as far as the longevity of an observatory, our club, the one that Marty and I belong to, the Warren Astronomical Society, we have an observatory that is located north of Detroit in a park. And it used to be a rotary campground, and it's now on a system of it's a multiple county system that's called the Metro Parks, and so it's still a public park. But working with parks and working with municipalities, there's, you know, surprising number of challenges. You can't necessarily count on something to be there forever.
It's actually like a corporation park, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's not a public park, it's not a state park, but I think it's actually owned by a corporation.
Right. Well, you bypass, people get in. It's, you know, it's not like it's very restrictive. They do a lot of public events. But again, you're dealing with suburbs and exurbs, and the skies have degraded terribly over the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a problem. And then we have a sister organization on the west side of Michigan that has an observatory, a very nice one, but it's on private land that's land that has family ties, land that will ultimately have heirs and probate court and things like that. And so comparing notes between our challenges with our observatory and the other clubs, there's so many pitfalls to building something like you want to build that's going to be hopefully around for generations. And so it intrigues me that you're looking not at dealing with, say, a park system, which was the first thing that came to mind when you were explaining about having it, you know, be a long-term project, but with a trust.
That's right. And I think that's the direction that we're probably going to go in. I know from what you're describing with the park service or the park system that, you know, your observatory is in is very similar to another observatory that was part of a club that I used to belong to. When I was in training in optometry school, I went to school at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. And the Birmingham Astronomical Society had a really nice observatory, a really nice roll-off roof observatory that had a 12-inch reflector and a 5-inch refractor in it. And they had it at the city's greenhouse facility where the city grew all their plants. It was a fairly rural kind of a setting. And it was only about 5 or 7 miles as the crow flies outside of town. So it was relatively easy to get to. The members could go down there. They could observe. And it was an ideal setting at the time. Of course, skies weren't pitch black, but they were still pretty nice. But exactly what you're describing happened. Something happened with the municipality, and they closed down the greenhouse. Mm-hmm. And of course, when they closed down the greenhouse, they had to move the observatory.
Yep.
And so all that effort and time and sweat equity and money that went into building that infrastructure was for naught. And the instruments got disassembled, and and part it out. And so they had to build another observatory much, much further from town, which is a lot less convenient and under a darker sky, but still nonetheless much harder to get to. So I'm thinking about what kind of model would work. And I think an academic institution makes sense. And that means a community college or a college. Well, there just happens to be a really nice community college not far from where I live, just about 10 or 15 minutes down the road in a direction that's under even darker skies than we have in my backyard. And that's called Germana Community College.
And that's where I got my degree in electrical engineering there, 1980.
Yeah, it's a good school. It sits on land that was donated by the Germana Foundation, which has 156 acres along the Rapidan River, and is entrusted to preserving and protecting that land so that it stays in a pristine state. And indeed, some of the nicest older forests in our area are along the river on the Germana Foundation land. It's amazing the view of the forests change when you go into that area because it has not been cleared, has not been developed for many, many years longer than anything else around here. So it's truly a different kind of a forest that's there. And so they're serious about protecting that land. And so I envision perhaps, and I haven't really approached them well very, very much yet on this. It's still in the very preliminary stages. But I envision maybe our observatory somehow being affiliated with either Germana Community College or Germana Foundation, both of which have potential for long-term stability on this project. But it is a challenge, and it is a major concern now that we've built this and put so much effort. I mean, Jerry and I have been working on this, as have other members of our Rappahannock Astronomy Club. They've come out, they've swung hammers and cut wood and poured concrete and have helped with this. We put a lot of effort into this. I just really would not like to see this go away if, like, let's say I move or, we decide that we just don't have the time or effort or desire to do this anymore. I'd love to be able to have this thing take a life of its own and carry on. And so that's why we created this commission. We also not only have a club, but we have a observatory commission. So the Mark Slade Remote Observatory has the Mark Slade Remote Observatory Commission. And it's a group of five or six people that are tasked with charting the direction and maintaining operation and achieving the mission statement of this observatory. We're in charge of fundraising. We're in charge of trying to increase the usefulness and maintain the observatory in an operational state. So it's a big task, and we have meetings about every 2 months at one of our members' houses, and we talk about the observatory, what we've done in that past 2 months, and where we see it going in the future. And right now, our next topic, Jerry is heading this up actually, is trying to get maybe perhaps tax exempt status for the
501c3. Yeah, 501c3 status.
So then we can perhaps start soliciting some funding from various foundations.
Yeah,
that might be able
that's
to help us with that.
On process.
It is a long process, it's a detail, and it's a lot of a lot more complexity. But I think we have to go there if we're going to ensure the long term longevity of this facility.
What goes along with that, Diane, is the performance of this. You know, for me, getting this observatory up to professional standards as inexpensively as we can with today's modern equipment and software and everything else that's available to amateurs. That's really one of my primary goals for this system, to really demonstrate that you can do professional level research with small telescopes that are remotely operated and can be, amateurs can be taught how to do that kind of level of observing and provide data that fills in gaps that professionals don't have time to do, basically.
Jerry, that's an admirable goal.
Yeah, there's one user that we have a number of people who are interested in using the observatory. And just maybe this might be a good segue into what is actually being done at this observatory right now. We have one person who is interested in observing variable stars, specifically cataclysmic variables like SS Cygni, mm-hmm. but specifically at a time when very, very few other people are observing. So he's using the observatory. He wants to use the observatory to fill in that light curve that's generated by like the AAVSO at mm-hmm. a time when that star is not being observed very often. For instance, like in the this time of year, early in the morning, SS Cygni is low in the northeastern sky. So he wanted to use the observatory for that. Unfortunately, our local horizon is preventing him from getting those observations as early as he would like, but he's still yep. going to use it. And he'll still get observations earlier than perhaps he might have otherwise done, because all he's got to do now is get onto his computer in his house and he can make the data. Mm-hmm. Another thing that this observatory has been used for, and it's not really research or science, but it's sort of to help people who have lost loved ones and who have had stars purchased for them. You know, these companies that are out there that
yes.
sell quote unquote air quotes.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, as an amateur astronomer, you know, I'm sure you all feel the same way that I do about it. It's just like, it just doesn't seem right. You know, it seems like maybe these people are being taken advantage of. At least that's my feeling. But at the same time, to them, a lot of these people I'm finding actually are provided relief and closure, knowing that there is a star that's named in the sky after their loved one. And what I get almost on a 2 or 3 times a year basis is somebody contacting me saying, hey, can you get me a picture of this star that is named after my son, daughter, wife, husband, whoever it is that passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have been doing this now for several years. Well, more than several years. Gosh, I've taken pictures of these stars probably half a dozen times over the past 5 years or so, or 7 years. And invariably they're very, very faint, and they're in crowded star fields that the person who bought the star or who was given the star as a gift would never be able to tell which one it is.
Yep.
But with our software, we're able to pinpoint which star it is and get a picture of it and then print it out and send it to the person, and they're very appreciative of this. So we actually have right now an observation request that's going to be obtained here in the near future of a star that was given to one of my wife's friends.
Mm-hmm.
Her son was killed in a motorcycle accident recently, and one of her friends bought her this star in honor of her son. And so the star's named after her son, and she is very distraught, as you can imagine, but knows that she'll feel a little better if she knows that there's a star in the sky that's named after her son. And so we're going to get a picture of it for her. So that's another purpose of this observatory.
Mm-hmm.
We're also, I don't know if the last time we were on, I guess I mentioned it. We were able, you know, I'm into minor planet work and tracking asteroids, and I was able to obtain our observatory code from the Minor Planet Center for the Mark Slade Remote Observatory last year.
Nice.
Which was a pretty good achievement, I think, you know.
Yes.
Not everybody wants to do that, of course, and there's ways that you can submit data to the Minor Planet Center without doing that, but I just, for me, it's just part of this, of trying to demonstrate our level of professionalism with the observatory and help maybe lend us a little more credibility. I think that's my purpose in the in it.
And another,
of course, I want to be able to. I also want to submit observations, of course, of what I can. So,
and another use of it's going to be Jerry and I went over to the a local high school last week, and we gave a talk in front of high school students that were connected via a video network. So there was literally probably 100 or more students watching us. And we talked to them about the observatory. And one of the things that they have to do is a major science project. They started in their 11th grade and they have to complete it by the 12th grade. It's called their culminating project.
Oh boy.
And they We have let them know that this observatory is available for their use if they would like to as well, to use it for their culminating project. So we have local students as well that are going to be using this observatory.
Yeah, that was something that caught my attention in one of the write-ups, was the focus on getting student hands on quite nice equipment. So you want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's a bit different. We do, you know, certainly, say at our observatory, we invite the public in, but we're focused on, it's mostly adults who show up.
Yes.
Right.
And,
right.
And that's the key, is we're specifically focusing on the younger members of society, high school and middle school students. If you can catch them at that age and start a spark that's an interest in science or math, you might be able to actually to help them achieve a goal someday down the road where they become a scientist or a mathematician and can attribute an observation or a discovery, you know, to humanity. So if we can get students interested in science and math, I think that's a good thing. And that's sort of what we want to try to do, because research can be fun, and applying the scientific method can be a lot of fun.
It sure
can. This is a way of letting these students actually, hone their skills on real scientific research and real scientific equipment, and can actually
scientists. Right, and this equipment, you know, you can automate this thing up to, you know, up the yin yang, and so where all you're doing is submitting an object to a list, and it goes out and then sends you data back, and that's not what the purpose of this observatory. Even though it's remotely operated, it's really meant to be a hands-on laboratory to learn the techniques and learn how it is to really operate a telescope and all the software that's involved with it. So that's the level of automation that we're striving for. You want the equipment to disappear, but you want to be actively involved with it and doing the observations. You don't want to get so remote from it that you're just clicking on an object on a star and say, submit this for an observation, and wake up tomorrow and there's your picture, that type of thing. You know, you might as well just go out on the internet and search for it in one of the existing databases. I mean, to me, you know, part of the thrill is actually doing the observation. It's not just right. Being able to see what you look at and understand it. You know, that's the training aspect. That's what students need to learn, is really what's involved, you know. To me, you know, I've been in computer systems for a long, you know, for 30 plus years, and I always had the saying, you can automate stuff too much. You know, you can over automate stuff to where you just forget how to do whatever it is, and you rely on it to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not, I don't think that's good for anybody, in my personal opinion. I just don't like it.
Nobody learns anything. Nobody learns anything that way.
So learning is, they learn by doing. And that's the lesson, is that they actually can do this for themselves. And in doing so, the methodology becomes internalized, and they actually understand what they're doing. And that's where the learning occurs. And so this is a unique facility and experience, I'm hoping, that will allow them to gain hands-on experience with scientific research.
That's something else that my boss, Scott Roberts, is looking into. We've talked. He's talked to us about being able to offer. He calls them experiences on the Explore Scientific website. They're actually things that you can sign up for, and for these activities. And he would, you know, we would host it as a company, and provide a way to help generate funding for the MSRO. Also, that's one of the goals, to where people can. You know, it's just like you go to a famous observatory like Yerkes Observatory. One of the things that Scott Roberts has done, we were able to get a contract to provide all the eyepieces for the 40-inch Yerkes Observatory, which is
cool. That is very cool.
So they've opened Yerkes up for visual observations.
Yes, my husband got to do it last year for the opposition to Mars.
Right, and so we're providing, Explore Scientific is providing the eyepieces for that activity. And that's an experience that we're offering on the website to go observe, do a private observing session with the Yerkes. And this is going to be another type of private observing session, remote observing using some of the equipment that Explore Scientific makes and can be shown how it operates in a real observatory.
So if anybody is interested in okay, how do I use this observatory? How do we actually, get to the point where I'm actually making observations? The first step is to contact either Jerry or myself. And probably the best way to do that would be to log on to or access the Rappahannock Astronomy Club's website.
Yep.
And there's a link.
That link.
Yep. There's a link to the observatory from there. And that's probably the best way to do that. And that would be www.raclub.org.
Yes.
And the website then will take you to a page where you can fill out information about yourself and contact information and what you'd like to do with the observatory. And then either Jerry or I will get back in touch and we'll make it happen. We'll find out exactly how comfortable the observer is with using the different systems of the observatory. And we'll ask you to download TeamViewer onto your computer so that you can actually see the observatory control computer. And then we'll help you. We'll talk with you on the phone like we're doing right now. And, guide you through the use of the various software that's required to operate the observatory, from the dome control to the CCD camera to the telescope charting software to aim and telescope and image process. And we'll give you help with how to get calibration frames if you want to do that. If you're not really sure about how to obtain a flat field or what the difference is between a bias frame and a light frame, we'll help you with that. We'll teach you what you need to know to get the data that you want. If you're so inclined and you want to be able to use the observatory on your own, we'll help you do that too. We'll train you on the various software, and when you feel comfortable and we feel that you're ready, we'll turn the keys over to you, and you can use the observatory unsupervised. We won't have to be there with you. So it is a learning curve. It's not, like Jerry says, just a plug and play where you ask for an observation and you know, although you can do that if you want, we would hope that you would want to be more involved with getting the data yourself. And we're here to help you with that. So
yeah, we kind of operate as robots in that regard. If you just got a request to get an image for something, we can take the request and do the observation for you, and we'll provide the data.
Mm-hmm.
That type of thing. And we picture that like for student projects and things that students, they may not have a lot of time to learn exactly how to operate the system. It depends on what their goals are. But there may be projects that they need to do that just they need some source for images that are unique or custom, or not custom, but, their own, basically. When you sign up to do imaging with the system, you own the data. We're not going to take ownership of it by any means.
Nice.
So would you say, you are fully up and running remotely?
Yeah, we can operate the system remotely easily. The systems are pretty much up and running. We're still tweaking, and there's still some things. I've got to do some work with the G11 mount with the telescope drive master. That's not operational yet. We're using an auto guiding system right now, which to me is more of a pain, compared to using the telescope drive master. But that's just what we're dealing with right now. We can get some good data now. And I'm hung up in performance, so I'm probably getting a little carried away with trying to tweak everything a little bit more than what we really need it to be. But I just, that's my job, I guess. but it's very usable right now. We can, every clear night this month, I mean, we've pretty much every clear night we've been on it.
Yep.
Nice.
Since the beginning of the year, practically, right? I think
yes.
Since the beginning of the year.
Another thing I'd want to mention too is we also have a professional astronomer on our commission.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So we have somebody who's generously offered her time to answer questions, theoretical or practical, to a user of the observatory who might have questions about, okay, well, how this is what I'd like to do. How do I go about getting this information? And so we have an astronomer who can actually answer questions. So we're trying to make this, trying to bring as many resources together as we can to allow whoever wants to use this observatory to do so successfully and have it as an enjoyable experience as well. So it's a free internet telescope, which we're really trying to get the word out that it's available and we want people to use it and we want it to be a resource to the amateur astronomy community. And just a lot like the one, I mean, there was a free internet telescope years ago that was a result of Timothy Ferris's video that he put out, Seeing in the Dark.
Yes.
There was a nice grant that came through for about a year or so afterwards they funded that telescope. But eventually it stopped because the funding ran out. I don't want that to happen with this one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one suggestion from the chat room was, have you thought about doing a podcast where participants can run the scope?
Yeah. Well, that's something
that the commission has talked about. We have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked about that. Right now, we're geared towards using TeamViewer as the conferencing tool to be able to get in and have multiple people on the system at the same time. Podcast, I guess, would be, correct me if I'm wrong, is that'd be more of a one-way thing where we share what we're doing on the system and maybe take suggestions on to do different things. Is that kind of what you're talking about there?
I think that's what Dale Aqua for you in the chat room. I think that's what he's getting at.
Okay. I was thinking about something like that too. If you guys can run the scope, do some imaging. You know, it's going to be a tricky timing the weather and the daylight and everything else together. You guys put some images up where people can go onto the site and watch what you're doing and talk through us about what you're taking images of and stuff like that. Maybe we'll put together a show, something like that.
That'd be cool. Yeah. Have a interactive, not just a chat, but have some interactive stuff going on also.
Yeah. Interactive audio. Mm-hmm. We'll work on something like that. Obviously, as we get towards, summertime, yeah, it doesn't work so well. So maybe we'll, plan ahead, do some test stuff, things like that, and maybe for the fall, next fall, something like that.
Yeah, that'd be very good.
So we make sure we have dark skies, and then we'll just kind of play it hit and miss with the weather so that we can all of a sudden just announce it. We got a clear night in Virginia, and we're going to do some live imaging.
Deep sky imaging, if we wanted to. We could have people request observations of various objects. We could get images there and demonstrate its capabilities. That'd be awesome. We could do that.
I'd like to plug my books real quick, if that's okay.
Please do.
Sure.
If you search Amazon, you can search for scientific astrophotography, and you can search for remote observatories for amateur astronomers, and then include the name Hubble. It's spelled H-U-B-B-E-L-L versus Edwin Hubble's name.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then so just search that, and you'll find my books. Or you can just search Gerald Hubble on Amazon, and it should come up also.
Let's mention your publisher, too.
Springer Books published both the books, and they're very, very good that way. And they're after me to do another book, but I think it's going to be a little while. I'm not sure what it would be about, but... they're an excellent publisher.
Yes,
and they put out a wide variety of books. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with what they put out.
Great. Well, we're down to our last half a minute or so, so time for us to wrap up this program. Really appreciate you guys being here tonight.
Indeed. This is a great project.
Great show. Stick around after the show. We'll talk a little bit more after the show. I want to thank everybody that's been in our chat room tonight. Appreciate you being here, sticking around with us. Sorry, we had a little bit of a glitch. I had a little bit of a glitch getting started, but we got it all together now, so that's great. All right, everybody. We appreciate you being here. Don't forget we got coming up, Astronomy Ireland, and we haven't had them for a little bit, so... catch up on listening back to them again. So stick around, everybody. All right. Appreciate you being here. See you all again next week. Thanks a lot, everyone. And good night.
Clear skies, y'all.
Good night. Thank you.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
AFM.